Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. This episode is sponsored by Freed, an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you instantly. The story behind this is the love story. Gabby, a family medicine physician, is married to Erez, who's a computer engineer. And we've all been there. Gabby was spending significant hours at night completing her charting, and Erez wanted to spend time with his wife. So in order to do that, and with the skill set that he had, he created Freed. And this is such a phenomenal product. I used it. It literally captures the encounter and generates a note. Think as if you had an invisible scribe sitting right next to you, except it's artificial intelligence. We're in a really cool era right now. So this Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. And the charting is done as soon as the patient leaves the room. It is HIPAA compliant, and it takes less than 30 seconds to learn. Make sure to try the free version, meaning you can do 10 free encounters before you have to subscribe. I promise you, this is a game changer. And don't forget, when you do subscribe, use clinical50, code clinical50 for $50 off your first month.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you won't be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers.
Reza, that was low energy.
I think you know why, but I can't say it out loud.
Oh,
I think you know exactly why.
I see.
But that energy, first of all, I honestly think you more than anyone in this world knows exactly what my mood is, just based on my face or the volume of my voice or the emphasis of the words.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to let you talk because this is the Reza show and I've taken it over.
Reza, I'm here today with a very special gift to imbue you with joy and to invigorate you. Why? Because I owe you 250 actual dollars of money. But I'm going to actually save this story for next time because we only have 30 minutes today.
But I will share a longer story. Robbie did make up for that 250 at dinner that we recently had in San Francisco. I told him, let's put it on CP Solvers. He's like, wait a minute, Rez, you want to put this dinner for your birthday dinner on CP Solvers? So he paid $366. You might say, well, what kind of dinner was that? Well, audience, there's always more than one way to get to that figure. There was more than just four people. There was six. So quit judging me.
Oh my gosh, wow. Prof. Rez's mood is dim, but his boxing gloves are on. Let's go. Prof. Rez, you're going to need to be very sharp for what's happening because distinguishing a tricky case from a simple one is made a lot harder by volume. And I think, you know, here we get to discuss one case at a time. But it's really, really hard when you're seeing a lot of patients to know when to slow down. And we talk a lot about S1 versus S2 thinking. And I think different people subscribe differently to how much they believe that stuff. But I think one thing is true is you can't slow down every time. And you have to think about when you do. And so that is a real life challenge. Another real life challenge, Prof. Rez, is when you have multiple patients with the same problem and you know that one of them has something unusual and the other doesn't. And that's the scenario that we're going to talk about today. So this is an artificial construct of two patients who are real life patients, but did not come at the same time. But to be able to extract the learning, we're going to pretend that we're taking care of them simultaneously, which actually probably for many of you working in general medicine would not surprise you. So Prof. Rez, we're going to go into the two triage rooms sequentially, okay? The first chief concern is worsening back pain. This is a 72-year-old woman, and I walk in there, and I see that she looks fairly well and not in too much pain sitting down. I glance over the vital signs and they seem completely normal. And the room seems calm and collected. There's not much intensity or emotion in the room. And I had heard from the whiteboard that it said back pain on there. So I was like, oh, I'm sorry, your back's hurting you, huh? And she says, yeah, you know, I've had back troubles for so long, all my life. But the last couple of weeks, it's been really, really hurting in my lower back. I think it's because when I was helping my husband with some chores in the lawn, they were gardening together and whatnot, and she just like exerted herself too much that day. So she started her usual routine of ibuprofen and Tylenol, and she's been getting a little bit better, but it's really been 2 weeks, and so she's kind of annoyed by it. She doesn't really report any other symptoms. She walked into the room. She has no fevers, no chills, no weight loss, nothing else going on except this issue. And so I actually don't examine her. I asked the nurse to triage her to one of the urgent care rooms where she can be seen in more detail in a moment. But because of the fact that she's been uncomfortable, we offer her a Toradol shot, an IM etorolac for pain relief, which is also helpful. So what happens next is she's then moved into one of the urgent care rooms, and I put in the Toradol shot with plans to see her in about 10 minutes and talk to her in more detail. Other room, 54-year-old man is coming in for back pain. And walk in the room, energy seems the same. There's no intensity, calm, collected. Walked into the triage room, pain for the last 10 years. Why? He actually jumped out of, he was a paraglider. He jumped out of planes and had a lot of rough landings. And so had a lot of back pain in the military. But over the last month, his pain has gotten much worse. He's just really, really uncomfortable. He's been taking ibuprofen with relief, but it's just really annoying. And his wife was like, listen, you got to do something. You can't just tolerate this pain. We got to do something for you. And no fevers, no chills, no weakness, no systemic symptoms. I get the exact same vibe. Let's go to a room and let's give some Toradol. And I'll stop there for both those people. I'm curious where your head went, what you're
thinking. The first place my head went to is, do we have sponsorship from Toradol or the pharmaceutical behind it?
We really should.
And then third, I want to say there's a third case of a recently turned 39-year-old man, extremely fit, with terrific facial hair, who has pain in the right trap and neck and is relieved by a sinister cat named Gino.
No way. Really? And, yeah.
That's so cute.
That term is actually called kneading, is what he needs. And that's what Liz taught me. But it's so amazing. I'm like, please, Gino, come to the bed at night. I'm laying on prone. And I'm like, please, please. And then I feel like a 7-pound weight on my back. I'm like, thank goodness. Oh. And then he starts putting his paws like a massage until he gets comfortable. But then I move a little to startle him. So then he gets comfortable again. You know, I love you, man. But I love your brother more, Sydney, who's like the best cat in the world. Okay. I'm so excited for today's case. I just want to acknowledge, like, you're one of the best storytellers. And like, I think the audience are already at the edge of their seat. And I don't think we really have covered back pain in detail on RLR. So to have that as a chief concern, I'm already looking forward to the hours of reading that I plan to do. By the way, recently I walked with Gurpreet on the Land's End Trail.
Yeah.
And he said, I always hear you and Robbie say hours of reading. Is it really hours? And two, how many hours can you read about gonorrhea?
Can you tell him the answer was 35?
I feel like I do inflate my hours of reading. Like if it's 1 hour of reading, I'm like, man, I read it for 5 hours. But anyway.
Not to be scandalous or stereotypical, but I've heard that's called the Middle Eastern double. which is why you have two cases today instead of one problem.
So, Robbie, I think what we can do is just first talk about a general approach to back pain and then talk about these individual patients. So, in all who present with back pain, I would say the majority, maybe 95% or more, is due to some kind of benign process that will get better. It's almost like that person with fever that we just label as viral NOS. For back pain, it's the same. It's MSKNOS. Now, it could be the muscle, it could be the spine, it could be something. In these patients, over the next 4 weeks, almost all of them get better. Now the question becomes, so who should we have a heightened alarm for? And this is a huge concept in medicine, and it doesn't only apply to chest pain. It applies to jaundice. It applies to the red eye. It applies to headache. It's the concept of red flags. And I would encourage you to always create red flags for these common symptoms. So what are the red flags for back pain? Some of those red flags are fiery hot. Some of them are lukewarm. You'll see an incredible schema on this created by the best R in the world. The hot ones include someone comes in with a focal neurologic deficit, right? Then this is an emergency. You wouldn't be like, let me give an IM Toradol and see them in a minute. That you're like, okay, focal neuro deficit, they walked in. How can I preserve their neural function? I need a stat MRI. I need to get neurology on board. Do I have to give steroids immediately? And there, you're worried about some kind of compression of the spinal cord. The more lukewarm stuff, though, there's still red flags, and they would push you to act quickly, but maybe not as quick as a focal neurologic deficit, is if someone has signs of inflammation. And folks, apply inflammation to almost any symptom, and that's a red flag. And inflammation can come in the form of weight loss. It can come in the form of fever. It can come in the form of an abnormal lab, like a leukocytosis or elevated ESR. In fact, the spinal epidural abscess, more than half those folks don't have fever. But really, it's back pain and a high ESR that should clue you in to that diagnostic possibility. Another red flag would be if someone has a history of cancer. Because we know cancer, specifically the lower cancers, they like to spread to that lower spine through Gaston's or Baston's plexus. Now, I only remember that as the Beauty and the Beast Gaston, but I know it's not, it's something that rhymes with Gaston.
Yeah,
it is Gaston. Okay.
No, it's Baston.
Baston's. Okay, Baston. Baston's plexus. So bottom line is, Robbie, if there's markers of inflammation, if there's focal neurologic weight loss, if there's sudden onset back pain, because sudden onset makes us think of a disc or vertebral fracture or some kind of vascular problem like a spinal infarct, those are things that would make me act quickly and invest a lot of cognitive energy. The other thing that may be relevant is if the back pain isn't lumbar, because most of these causes of back pain NOS that end up being reassuring is usually in the lower back, in the lumbar spine, that we say a muscle is strained or there's spondylosis or something like that. And I think one of the greatest mistakes is to have a red flag and then just blame the patient, you know, had a bad turn of the spine. The patient bent over and had this back pain, because those shouldn't cause any of the red flags that I mentioned. And just really quickly, I know we don't do this ordinarily. Are there red flags that you would add, Robbie, beyond those?
Absolutely superb. No, nothing, Brock.
Okay. So in these two patients, there are no red flags, at least on first glance. Now, the neuro exam may show something subtle that the patient didn't recognize, or the labs may show that there's a marker of inflammation, or there may be a past medical history. The only two things that sort of separate these two patients, so again, there's no red flags, is that the first patient who was 72 says, hey, like, I'm starting to get better, but just not at the pace I want to get better. While the second patient is not getting better and it's worsened. And it's like so bad that the wife is like, you got to go to the urgent care. So what would I do next for these patients? It's really going to be that touching their spine, doing a quick neuro exam. And honestly, in patient number one, unless you tell me something differently, it's like if they're telling me they're getting better, I would just make sure they're not taking too much ibuprofen, at which point I might add something to decrease acid secretion so they don't have like a peptic ulcer. But patient number two, I'm just a little worried because it's not getting better and it's like just progressively worsening over the past month.
Prof. Rez, I think you're appropriately worried, but maybe you should be worried about patient number one more, because when I went and talked to her, she said, oh, I forgot to tell you, I also, whenever I walk, I get really cold. And I said, what? Really? When you exert yourself, you get cold? And
is this real? Or are you getting back?
Of course not. So I went and I examined her. I'm just going to get revenge on Prof Rez for last week's episode forever and ever and ever. I went and examined her, and she had a phenomenal exam, completely normal exam. She got Toradol. She felt much better. And so actually, I just discharged her and gave her some lidocaine patches and sent her on her way. She was very happy.
Quick question for you, Robbie. The Toradol, this is your go-to, like, you don't check, you're just like, hey, like, their prior labs are okay. You give, is it 30 or 15 or what is it?
15 milligrams IM. There's been studies to see what the difference between 30 and 15 is, and there's no difference in efficacy. A one-time dose of NSAIDs really has no contraindications to it apart from anaphylaxis. You're not going to get the GI bleed from one dose of NSAIDs. You're not going to get heart failure or CAD or even renal failure from one dose of NSAIDs. So there's really no utility in even knowing labs or whatnot.
How quickly do they respond?
It's a very variable response. It's hard to standardize it. But if you take a sum total of experience, I think a lot of people find decent relief in the first 30 minutes.
Incredible. And last question for you. What return precautions did you give her?
Oh, you know, honestly, I didn't give her return precautions because I said, hey, you know your body. If you ever need us, come on back. And I think that, you know, when somebody's been living with a condition for a long, long time, they often know it better than you do. And this is a good learning point where, like, if you walk into that piece of paper saying, hey, if you've got fevers, but, you know, like, patient knows the disease very well. So for people like that, the read in the moment is, and you know, that's what I said to her. You know your body very well. If you ever need us, come on back. The other patient was very different, Prof Rez. I walked in and I got a more detailed history, in large part because I picked up on something that I didn't really realize until I talked to him more, which is something you picked up on. He's not getting better. He said for a whole month, his pain has just been really, really bad. Dude, by the way, for all of you listening, there's a dog barking outside. And for the first time in NAR's 3.5-year history, he is not responding. You're not going to respond? Well, anyway, so yeah, he's been getting worse and worse for a whole month. But I talked to him and it sounds like he's just been getting worse for 10 years. And it's just that this last month represents a level of pain that is so intolerable. But if we really draw out the line, for 10 years, the line has been getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Just about a month ago, it got to a level where it was so painful that it just really started to reduce his functional capacity. And then the other thing happened. I asked him, where's your pain? And he pointed to his thoracic spine. So let me just tell you, Prof Rez, that the rest of his exam is completely normal. And I'll stop there.
Wow. That, I think, is quite telling. There's two, like, lukewarm red flags. The fact that he can point to where the pain is, and it's in his thoracic spine, not lumbar spine. And the fact that there's been no improvement, and it's almost like a step-up approach in terms of severity of pain. And that makes me think of one of two possibilities, Robbie. The chronic back pain suddenly has an acute component, an acute pathology, or this new thoracic pain is unrelated to what his usual back pain is. Meaning now we're dealing with, as opposed to chronic with decompensation, we're dealing with a subacute process that's progressively worsening. And now the approach to back pain of the thoracic spine, really you should just take an anatomical approach. And the best physical exam maneuver you can do in this patient is palpate and percuss his spine. Because oftentimes patients who have pathology in the spine, specifically osteomyelitis, they will have tenderness to percussion. You have to percuss because it can't be too gentle on that spinal area. So usually I start away from that and percuss, and then I get there and I percuss, but I start with palpation. But then you have to also be open to the fact that you're not dealing with a spinal process, but rather a paraspinal process. And that's when it's good to think about skin and soft tissue. Like if someone had zoster, even without the rash, zoster sine herpetae, they can have sort of a painful distribution, but that's often dermatomal. Muscle stuff, like you could still be dealing with like a muscle spasm, but it would be really odd for a muscle spasm to last this long. But you can be dealing with a myositis, for example. Or how about the back pain in the thoracic spine is actually referred from another thoracic organ as opposed, and this is where I would think like what is towards the back. And there we have stuff like the lung and things like that. And Robbie just texted me, and it's so funny. He's like, I'll be right back. Have to get an image. And I'm running out of things to say when I don't see his beautiful face.
This episode is brought to you by our great friends at Glass Health, who have created the best digital notebook for you to keep track of all your learning in medicine, and who are doing some phenomenal stuff leveraging AI to augment the skills of clinicians for their patients.
But I have a picture to share with you, Prof. Renz.
Beautiful. So Robbie, like, I'm going to keep this brief and think of it like an ED doctor. I'm like, okay, I have to rule out a spinal fracture. I have to make sure there's no inflammation, make sure there's no muscle involvement. So my next test, diagnostic test, would be an X-ray of that thoracic spine, of that back, looking specifically for fracture. And I would have a low threshold to send the inflammatory markers to see if I'm dealing with an inflammatory cause of spinal or paraspinal pain.
Absolutely superb, Prof. Rez. I would love to get, this is probably not something many people have actively thought about, but it is the reflection that I had after this case that allowed me to try to consolidate and understand this question. So I did not have an answer to this question in real time, but I was forced to think about it for this patient. What are the causes of back pain that are secondary, meaning that are specific, that are chronic progressive? Because here's the problem. The problem is everything that we talk about that's bad in terms of a cause of back pain is either acute or subacute, right? Cancer, osteomyelitis, so on and so forth. And whenever we hear chronic, we turn our heads off, turn our ears off, or whatever, our brains off, because we don't think that there could be a bad, progressive, chronic back pain, right? Or that's specific. In other words, borrowing from headaches, if a headache lasts for 10 years, we'd say, oh, that can't be a primary headache syndrome. If it literally lasts every day for 10 years, that's what this person's back pain was. When you realize, talk to him, he's like, every day for the last 10 years, I've been getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Now that requires confidence to be sure that you're not dealing with acute superimposed on chronic, right? And that's where I can tell you, Prof. Rez, superb historian, very crystal clear. This is not a mismatch in time course. This is a truly chronic, yet progressive, debilitating, unrelenting cause of back pain. So the question is, it's not going to be a cancer for 10 years. It's not going to be an infection for 10 years. What can we diagnose for sure? And I think that's a fun exercise to do. I drew a blank in real time. But I'll tell you, the imaging will really help you. But I would love for all of you to get the opportunity to practice, to be like, what can we come up with to better reinforce the learning after?
Incredible. And if I went through that exercise in real time, but I can't wait to hear your reflection. I think it's such a wise point that if there were infection, it would be almost inconceivable. And in terms of malignancy, also probably inconceivable, unless you had like a primary benign tumor that later gets, you know, complicated by some kind of destructive process. And I you know, I thought about osteoporosis because it's so common. The thing that argues against that, I mean, really nothing much. It's usually the most weight-bearing joints of the lumbar spine, like the hips, the knees. But it could involve the thoracic spine. Unlike rheumatoid arthritis, which I often think about RA when I'm thinking about osteoporosis, which really involves the cervical region and spares the thoracic and lumbar spine. So I was thinking about osteoporosis, but if you hadn't, it's usually asymptomatic unless you have a fracture. But that's like acute on chronic. It's not like chronic and progressive. So I'll just stop speaking there and look at the image and then can't wait for your reflection.
Prof. Rez, to share with you authentically where I was, that's actually all I could think about in the moment, was the person has a chronic osteoporosis, osteopenia, and I was invoking the idea that he might have chronic microfractures, fracture. That was what I was thinking. So actually, it changed my management, because I've learned that the sensitivity for X-ray for compression fractures is only about 60%. That's why I went straight for a CT scan, thinking that I was going to find osteoporosis and compression fractures. But that's not what I found. And I'm going to text you the picture right now, and then we'll get these uploaded for all of you to be able to learn from them. So Prof. Rez, just to orient you, the first, I don't know if they come through yet.
Not yet, but I do have to say that the audience is actually holding us accountable for getting these uploaded, because anytime we say we do and we don't, the emails come through, and then we will definitely upload them. Yes, the images are here, my friend.
All right, Prophet, just to orient you, so this is the CT of the thorax spine, and you're getting an axial view and then a coronal view. And what it's centered on is the thorax.
I love it, man. And maybe I can start with the coronal view. And if I make a mistake, you can correct me right away. Mm-hmm. But what I see right away is this like lucency in one of the thoracic vertebra. And it's literally, audience, it's towards the posterior end of a thoracic vertebra. And it's almost like a punched out hole. Is that completely wrong?
Correct. Yes, it's completely wrong.
You know what I'm talking about, right? Like that little black spot.
All right, let me orient you, Prof. Rez. Okay, so here, look at my phone.
Yes.
So actually, Prof. Rez, I'll make it easier. I'm going to open and share the screen on Zoom.
Okay, perfect.
You guys, if you're pulling up, sorry, you can hear my voice in the... So I want you all to open up the coronal view, and then I want you to start to stare at all the vertebra and scan them to see if you see any major differences. But now I want you to look at the anterior aspect of the vertebra. So go all the way to cervical and look in front of the vertebra. And then as you hit the thoracic spine, you will see, boom.
Yes.
Fuse ossification of the anterior ligaments of the spine. The vertebrae are all totally normal. But what's abnormal is a large linear area of calcification that bridges the vertebra anteriorly. And if you go over and then you look at the sagittal view, if you look at the sagittal view, you'll see the aorta on the left side in front of the vertebra. And then you will see ossification in front of the vertebra only on the right side. There's no ossification in front of the vertebra on the left side. Do you see that, Prof. Rez?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
And that is diagnostic of a certain condition, which I learned from the neuroradiologist.
Okay. first of all, I do have to say that was awesome, man. Like, audience, I highly recommend that you go on the website to look at this. As I'm saying this, I'm seriously Googling. There's only one condition that comes to mind, but I don't know if it's right or not. And I don't think it is, but when I think of like spinal disease, and I don't have a good illness script for this, so I'll have to create my illness script for it. But just thinking about DISH, D-I-S-H, is the only thing that comes to mind. And that's not because it can only be this. It's because I don't have any other hypothesis. But I had to even remind myself what that stands for. It's diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, which sounds like, you know, ossification. And I think it's a mimicker of, I don't know enough about, so I'll stop talking. And I would love to just reflect with you on like what you learned from this case and what it ended up being.
I think this is the exact value of why we reflect and why we refine. So I'm honestly going to share my deep reflections and save it for the recap, because that's actually what happened. So I came, I had no idea what was going on in this case. It pushed me to reflect on what are chronic progressive causes of back pain. And there are five of them. And most of us have heard of them. We just forget about them. And this is a classic presentation of DISH, diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis. And I will share an illness script and a video for it later. But I encourage all of you to really reflect on this case. It was eye-opening for me. I spent, honestly, even without the Middle Eastern double, like at least 10 hours reflecting on this case. And he was thrilled to have a diagnosis. Unfortunately, there isn't really much good treatment for this condition. I went back and examined him after learning about this briefly on UpToDate, and I saw that he had hyperostosis other places on his Achilles and on his elbows and his shoulders. So much more to come, but I really want all of you to live through the learning that we did by going through the journey yourself, reading about it, reflecting on it. And we'll come at you next week with...
Can I share my favorite part of this case?
Yeah.
Was where I'm seeing punched out lesions. And I'm like, and you're like, nope.
And I got it.
Just sensing the joy in your heart.
Yes. Oh, I was so happy. But no, Prof. Rez, it's amazing. I'm curious, how did you reach for DISH? What You said that you hadn't read about it much or whatnot. What made you even Google it?
So I have seen, well, I've seen that word and I was thinking like anything in the spine, like literally I don't have too many like non-infectious, non-malignant diagnoses to consider. But I remember DISH and a CPS, but I never went to read about it deeply. And this is the value of RLR. Like, I really am so excited, like so excited to read about this. Because I bet the like we're probably underdiagnosing it. We're probably, you know, not on top of it because it sounds, you know, foreign, but it isn't.
And there's a very specific reason why you only see the ossification on the and not on the left.
Wow. Wait, you only see it where? Anterior and not posterior?
It everywhere. You see it in many places, but you don't see it on... Look at that axial.
Yes.
You see it on the left. You don't see it on the right where the aorta
is. Wow.
There's a very good reason for that. So there's a lot of beautiful pathophysiology too.
All right. We'll definitely upload these images and I'll also like circle the... Although the audience probably doesn't need it like I do, but I'll circle where you're talking about. Watch me circle the wrong thing.
That's a wrap, folks.
Clinical problem solvers. Are you tired of not getting publications and promoted? We can't help you with that. But if you want to listen to these types of episodes ad-free, subscribe to rlrcpsolvers.com. That is RR's child. It is all our work. We guarantee that you won't regret a subscription. And there's teaching videos, teaching figures, and reflection on most of our episodes.
2% of ED visits are for back pain. So we have to have an extraordinary approach, a thorough approach to back pain. And on our website, we have created 4 videos. One which includes the final diagnosis of diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, an overview of approach to lower back pain, red flags for back pain, and what can cause chronic progressive back pain. You don't want to miss this material on the website, but I'll tell you some of the highlights from our reflection of this incredible case. The patient in Robbie's case was not just someone presenting with lower back pain. In fact, 90% of us will experience lower back pain. So this patient had some lukewarm red flags, including the middle of the back, not the lower of the back, where the pain was located, and the progressive nature with acute worsening. And really, when you think about the differential diagnosis for back pain, it falls into one of 4 buckets. And let's say for lower back pain. One, that it's just nonspecific. Nonspecific means that it's probably related to the musculoskeletal system. Maybe the muscle is strained, maybe the disc, the bone, the ligament, but it's like back pain NOS. And these individuals often get better. The majority of them get better within weeks or months. In fact, this non-specific lower back pain, a huge clue to it is that it's acute in onset, less than 6 weeks. That's one bucket. Another bucket represents less than 1% of patients who present to their clinic, their primary care doctor, with lower back pain. And that's the real sinister etiologies. And let's just put a label on those to give you examples. Cord compression and cauda equina syndrome. Oftentimes, these will present first with back pain. You'll likely have motor and sensory symptoms, but the bowel bladder symptoms happen later in the disease course. Another do not miss cause of lower back pain is infection. I've missed it twice because it can present with just back pain. Half those patients don't have a fever and it just progresses over time. This is where I've started including ESR and CRP in some patients with risk factors for bacteremia. For example, if they are using IV drugs, they have an HD catheter, anything that might make them bother, they just had a procedure. In those patients, I have a low threshold to send an ESR and CRP because I know fever is absent in many of those individuals. I also love percussing the back because if they have no tenderness with percussion, it really lessens the likelihood of vertebral osteomyelitis. So the presence of tenderness to percussion is not specific for osteomyelitis. And you can imagine the infections include infections of the vertebra, osteo, the disc, discitis, or epidural space, where you can have an epidural abscess. The other thing is cancer is another one you don't want to miss. But cancer, especially if someone has active cancer or just recently treated cancer, and the bone, the spine and the bone is one of the most common sites that cancer spreads. This includes prostate, kidney, breast, lung, thyroid. It's not true that everyone who has cancer and comes in with lower back pain warrants MRI, but you have to just, you know, use your probability. Like if it's sudden onset, if it's severe, then you have to have a lower threshold to actually scan them. And then the other cause that you don't want to miss is compression fractures. And this is primarily in anyone with trauma or anyone who's older has osteoporotic risk factors, like is using glucocorticoids. Which brings us to, actually, before we go to where I'm about to go, let me finish the four buckets. So we said 90% of people who present with lower back pain to the clinic, it's nonspecific and they get better. Less than 1% of those individuals have one of those sinister etiologies that you can't miss. About 5 to 7% have another secondary cause, like spinal stenosis, spondyloarthritis, just spinal arthritis, which is referred to as spondylosis. It falls into one of those causes. And then the final group is non-spinal back pain, really the retroperitoneal organs, like the aorta, like the kidney, that's just referring pain to the lower back. So non-specific, less than 1% sinister etiology. The others is a spinal cause, but it's less sinister than the four that I mentioned. And then finally, non-spinal retroperitoneal pain. But the real question becomes, who gets imaging? And the truth of it is the majority, just based on the stats I gave you, do not warrant imaging. And if you are going to do imaging, you have three options, really four options, but let's just say three, x-ray, CT, MRI. You could also do CT myelogram. That was the fourth option, which we almost never do unless there's a reason we can't do an MRI for lower back pain. The x-ray, you know, it's not the best test, but if it shows something like a fracture, then it shows a fracture. If you're most worried about a bony abnormality, go for the CT. Otherwise, you should just wait for the MRI. But in the patient that presented to the ED, where Robbie took care of that patient had middle back pain. It was progressive. It was worsening. So he wanted to get some imaging. It takes a time to get an MRI. And the patient was in pain. So he got a CT scan, which showed DISH. But you had to go on the website to learn about DISH because we share an epic pearl of why it primarily involved the right side of the vertebra and not the left side. It's basically thickening of that longitudinal ligament, making the patient have a very stiff back. I really enjoyed this case because it really prompted me to learn about a very common symptom. And I'm sure that next time we have back pain, we'll even learn more about it. For the chronic progressive causes, go on the website, but those include the two S's, spinal stenosis, spondyloarthritis, and then DISH and epidural lipomatosis. We hope to see you on the next one, folks.